This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. All right, there's a picture of this. A gourmet chef is preparing your favorite meal, carefully, meticulously working on each individual piece of that dish while you impatiently wait and watch. The anticipation is almost overwhelming. But a good chef knows that we eat with our eyes. So maybe it's no wonder that some of our favorite movies are also the ones that make our mouths water. We're talking about your favorite food movies for this edition of Movies on the Radio. And this time, we'll also hear from some of North Carolina's greatest chefs about their favorite food films. With me, as always, Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State University. Hello, Marcia.
Hello, Frank.
And Laura Boyes, film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art. Hi, Laura.
Hello, Frank.
We got more response to this, Laura, than any other ask that we've done for film favorites. What do you suppose accounts for that?
Oh, that's pretty exciting. Everybody loves to eat.
I guess so. food film? You're not food eating films. The film. You're watching it.
I know. But, you know, if you think about it, almost any film, even films that are not food-centric, have eating scenes in them. I mean, it's just something that, is as a narrative device, I think is very useful. Family sitting around a table, a date, whatever the context is. And so I think it's only natural that there are so many, you know, different films that people respond to because of the representation of food.
Let's start with one of our chef picks. It's a foreign film called Mostly Marta.
My name is Ashley Christensen, and I'm a chef and restaurateur in downtown Raleigh, North Carolina. One of my favorite food movies is called Mostly Marta. First, I feel like so often we see food movies where food and restaurants and kitchens are really at a professional level, inaccurately portrayed. And I feel like in this movie, it really is very connected to how a lot of smaller mom-and-pop kitchens feel. There is a chef, and that's the main character, Marta. The movie is filmed in Germany, but the sous chef is this charismatic Italian gentleman, and he just sort of plops right next to her on the countertop, and he's eating this simple bowl of pasta, and he, you know, tears up a little fresh basil and puts it on top and lets her smell it. And he just sort of looks over and sets the bowl down and tells her to keep an eye on the pasta. And as he steps away, you know, she, of course, picks up the dish and just starts going to town on it. And it's this demonstration of how people sort of engage with food through the experiences of other people.
And of course, it's also the first of many of the films we're going to be talking about today where food is a cross-cultural experience, that you're used to eating a certain kind of food and maybe you don't want to eat somebody else's food. But if you embrace that experience, then you're letting this other person into your life in a very intimate way.
Well, and I also like that Ashley brought up the idea of authenticity, because I suspect that as a chef watching a lot of films in which that take place in restaurants, that you go, yeah, that's really the way it happens. But right. To find one that really depicts a kitchen, the way that it operates, and I mean, I would think that of all the professions out there, to be a chef, you have to be very driven and very obsessive, and it takes a lot of work and a lot of effort, and to see that depicted in a lazy way would probably get very irritating.
Well, here's another guy who knows his way around a kitchen, another chef here in North Carolina with his pick, this time comedy.
This is Billy Cotter. I'm chef owner of Dashi Restaurant and Toast in Durham, North Carolina. My favorite movie is Big Night. When that movie came out, I was working at a Pops restaurant, didn't know a lot about food. It really opened my eyes to the level of Italian cooking that was beyond the Italian-American that I knew, and kind of gave me a drive to learn about all the different regions of Italy. And my favorite scene would be when the Americans are the only customers in the restaurant.
Oh, that looks good. You got leaves with yours.
They're ordering risotto, and they want a side of pasta with their risotto. And Tony Shalhoub's character, Primo, just can't understand why they would need two starches.
Secondo, I want to know for who is it for? For the lady with the risotto. What?
Why? She likes starch. I don't know. Come on.
I make it myself.
What are these people in America?
Just the dichotomy between him wanting to do the right thing and his brother as a businessman just trying to make the American people happy. It was, I thought, a funny scene.
I need to talk to her. Oh, please, Prima, what are you going to do? Tell the customer what she can eat, huh? That is what she wants. That is what the customer asks for. Make it. Make the pasta. Make it. Make it. Make the pasta. Come on, let's go.
How can she want? They both are starch. Maybe I should make a mashed potato for on the other side.
No, okay? Because they are the first customer to come in 2 hours.
No. She's a criminal. I want to talk to her.
Yeah. Oh, it's great to hear a clip. This was such a fun film. I remember seeing this when it came out in the 90s. Stanley Tucci as a co-director and also star in it. But one of the things that I think is interesting about thinking about the films that we're going to talk about today is the representation of different kind of ethnicities and the cross-cultural nature. And obviously, this is playing around a lot with the idea of Italian and American culture, which is, you know, not unusual in representations of food on film. But that idea that that's one of the ways we experience culture is through eating and through eating the food of different nations and different ethnicities. So
it's certainly the most tangible aspect of the culture, one of the most tangible aspects. Right?
And this also, it's set in the 1950s, and that was a very transformative time in American food because so many soldiers went overseas during World War II and the Korean War, and they ate different kinds of food when they were overseas and came back and wanted to experience, sometimes in a very timid way, the kind of food that they'd eaten overseas.
And even though this film plays it for laughs, obviously there's beliefs, very deeply held beliefs about how we should eat and what kind of food we should eat and when. And the film, you know, has a good time with it, but it's also getting at something serious about the difference between cultures.
Just in those first two clips also, Marcia, it seems to me that we're seeing various different kinds of films. I mean, there are categories of food. They're not just food films, but
right.
They run all sorts of different genres themselves, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that there are as many comedies that people brought up, at least in terms of the feedback I got, as there are dramas, romantic films, you know. So I think, yeah, it runs the gamut. Everyone eats.
I am kind of surprised that Billy Cotter didn't pick Tampopo, though, which was about ramen.
Noodles,
because if
right?
it wasn't for Billy Cotter, I mean, I would never have eaten ramen like they eat in Japan. So I'd like to thank him for that.
We not only heard from chefs, but we heard from a lot of other listeners as well. And let's hear from one of them right now.
My name is Kyle Kincaid, and I'm calling from Greenville, North Carolina. And my favorite food movie is Julia and Julia. It's a movie that follows the story of Julia Child and her desires to create a French cookbook for American chefs.
I'm Julia Child. Bon appétit.
Well, during the 2000s, another young chef named Julie follows the recipes of Julia Child.
If I really wanted to learn to cook, I could just cook my way through Julia Child's cookbook. I could blog about that. I have a copy. I stole it from my mother last time I was in Texas. When I was 8, my father's boss came to dinner, and it was a really big deal, and my mother made bouffe bourguignon. But it wasn't just bouffe bourguignon, it was Julia's bouffe bourguignon. And it was like she was there, like Julia was there, in the room, on our side, like some great, big, good fairy. And everything was going to be all right.
And it also shows that both of their husbands are extremely supportive of them and their goals. The moment that's one of the most heartbreaking is where Julia Child actually hears of the blog and dismisses her as not a real cook. But the recipes that were created in the movie are just fantastic. They're just wonderful to look at for someone like me who's aspiring to become a chef one day. And seeing someone who can take all these classic French recipes and bring them to their own home.
Well, I think what's so timely about that pick is that it gets at a couple things. One is the idea of kind of a celebrity chef culture, which is a fairly recent phenomenon. And obviously, Julia Childs was the cutting edge figure in that. But that idea
that's a chef pun.
Yeah,
yes,
that was a good one.
Exactly. Thank you. Wow, I didn't even know I did it. Truly. But and then the idea that one of the things that we can do as ordinary people is to make amazing food by following the recipes in these cookbooks. And this idea that in our culture, too, now you can blog about them and then kind of create your own ancillary celebrity, which the film is also about.
This is Stanley Tucci again, obviously very attracted to these food films. But also, many people who went out and bought Julia Child's cookbook after this film were rather surprised to discover that her recipes are quite difficult and
right.
demand a lot of technique. And yeah, it's not something that you would assume lightly as a cooking task.
Well, I think, too, if we take a look at the celebrity chef culture and the cooking show culture, I mean, I think maybe we shouldn't have been so surprised if there's that much television and that much pop culture around cooking these days. We shouldn't have been too surprised.
The Food Channel is all about, easy things you can make for, it's not half an hour of, mincing. Which might involve.
They were not talking necessarily about eating so much. In this case, we're talking about chefs, too, and the idea that having the expert chef with you. In other words, I follow Julia Child's recipe, and therefore this is going to come out all right. It kind of cuts against the grain of that mom's home cooking where it was a pinch of this and a dab of that, right? I mean, it's sort of two whole ways of coming to understand food and the nurturing qualities of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also that idea that Ashley hinted at early in the show, that there's this kind of complexity in some representations of what a kitchen is actually like and what the labor involved is like versus this kind of more facile Food Network kind of understanding of like, bam, there it is.
Nothing to it. Just pull it out of the oven. Movies on the Radio on The State of Things. We're talking about your favorite food movies, Marcia Gordon and Laura Boy, slicing and dicing the films today. We'll hear from more of you and more of our celebrity chefs. All of that happens on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio with another edition of Movies on the Radio. Today we're talking about your favorite food movies and hearing picks from some award-winning chefs in North Carolina. With me, as always, Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys. Marcia is a film professor at North Carolina State. Laura is the film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. As I say, we've heard from a number of chefs already about their favorite food movie. Let's listen to one more.
My name is Vivian Howard, and I am the chef at Chef and the Farmer in Kinston, North Carolina. And my favorite food movie is called Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. I watched this movie in college, and I wasn't even a food person then, but I was really struck by the way the protagonist worked with food. It's basically the story of a widower and his three daughters, and he's a retired master Chinese chef, and they have this ritual Sunday dinner, and you watch him prepare the meal several times throughout the movie. It's my favorite food movie because so often in films and on television, people who are working with food don't look like they know how to do it. And this actor clearly at some point in his career was a chef. It seems like it's okay if you're an actor, you're willing to go like learn how to be a professional ballerina if you're playing a ballerina, but you don't have to learn how to use a knife to play a chef. My family, we also do a lot of our arguing and talking and visiting around the table. And I thought it was a really great way to express the way that food brings families together.
Yeah, there's a couple things about that I really like. One is, I think cooking and then also playing music. So often you have the cutaways in films because, the actors don't actually know how to play the music and they do a close-up on the hands on the piano or the guitar. But I really like the emphasis on the kind of ritualistic nature of food and eating as a way for films to get at important things about relationships, whether they're familial or romantic or what have you. And I was thinking about when we had our discussion recently of Citizen Kane and that important montage sequence of the dinner table that shows the deterioration of Charles Foster Kane's relationship. And just last night in my studio era Hollywood class, we looked at The Public Enemy, the Jimmy Cagney film from the 1930s. And there's that horrific moment where he slams half of a grapefruit in his girlfriend's face. And it's this moment of such degradation and humiliation and shows his monstrosity. So, I mean, it's a fantastic way to convey things about relationships.
Eat, Drink, Man, Woman also brings up a common theme in families, which is who is going to cook this food when the old person dies? Mm-hmm. Because lots of times younger people don't have the knowledge or the dedication or the inspiration to do it. They want to eat it, but they don't necessarily want to cook it.
Well, and again, getting back to relationships and you know, some important parts about the aspects of romantic relationships. I mean, it is about continuation, continuity, reproduction, and intimacy. And there's nothing more intimate that won't draw an X rating than eating, if you think about it.
Right. Well, and also that idea of kind of a generational inheritance, that this is cooking, you know, is something that you can share, you know, with children and grandchildren, and that it's a way for you to have memories of your family and your past.
We got a lot of responses about movies that were not technically food films. They surprised us in a way, but they did have elements of food in them, and quite interesting, really. Let's listen to one right now.
My name is Jake Wolf, chef and co-owner of Capital Club 16 Restaurant in downtown Raleigh. When it comes to food and movies, one of my favorite of all time characters is Chef Hicks from Apocalypse Now.
How come they call you that?
Call me what, sir?
Chef. Did you like mangoes and stuff?
No, sir. I'm a real chef. I'm a saucier.
Saucier?
Yes, sir. See, I come from New Orleans. I was raised to be a saucier. Great saucier.
What's a saucier?
We specialize in sauces.
There's not so much food in this movie, but his character is a straight-up kind of a tough guy character. He's in the middle of the Vietnam wilderness, but he would rather be in the kitchen of his native New Orleans. And the fact that he was a saucier is badass, because these days you don't really hear of a saucier. When I lived in Germany, I was the vegetable cook. I was an entremetier. And across the range was the saucier. So it all kind of like comes back around to me, you know.
I was supposed to go to Paris, study at the Scoffier School. Then I got orders for my physical.
He gets in the boat after the tiger attack. He says something like, I just want to be a cook. I just want to be cooking right now.
All I want to do is cook. I just want to learn to cook, man.
Being a saucier, and that's where you want to be. Sometimes I feel like, yeah, I just want to cook.
For many, many years, the kitchen was pretty essentially a male domain in restaurants. And Anthony Bourdain, in his book Kitchen Confidential, really talked about that sort of macho atmosphere in the kitchen, which is changing a great deal with some of the female chefs that we're listening to today. I think it's many people would consider that a welcome change.
And one of the things I like about Jake's pick is that it brings up a whole kind of film, which is the war film. And there's a long tradition, especially in Navy films, of having cookie or the chef or whatever play a really important role. And I mean, war films are about life being interrupted. And this is a perfect example.
Or on the wagon train.
Wagon train.
Yes,
yeah.
Right.
By the way, I noticed something when I was reading Sherlock Holmes. One of the things I noticed about that was there was not a single episode that I can remember where they didn't have breakfast. They always, it's one reason or another.
It's the most important meal of the day.
It was every one of those episodes they had, the breakfast was some part of that Sherlock Holmes.
Well, an English cooked breakfast is a very important, you know, way to begin your day with a gigantic greasy meal, you know, which is not my way to begin the day.
But that's part of cultural ritual that would get carried over into any representation, because otherwise it would not be an authentic representation of that culture.
That's right. Grilled tomatoes and kippers.
By the way, this does mark the first time that anyone on this show has ever said the fact that he was a saucier is badass.
Not the last, I hope.
No, I'm sure it'll happen more often now that he's broken the ice. Well, we talked about food films, and we did hear from people who were not chefs. Here's one of them.
My name's Mark McDonald. I'm from Pittsboro, North Carolina. And I did give this some thought. I do love a good big turkey dinner like in Meet Me in St. Louis. But for me, the first thing that came to mind was Animal House, because of the food fight. I can see John Belushi at the cafeteria, the line, with his tray there, and he's sampling various bits of food. It still makes me laugh. Just the expression on his face and that eyebrow. When he lifts that eyebrow, that does, it's just an exclamation point. And it set the tone for, like, my entire senior year in high school, I think.
Ray, really, can't you?
Oh, no, don't worry. Just keep your hands and feet away from his mouth.
Don't you have any respect for yourself?
This is absolutely gross. That boy is a P.I.G. pig.
See if you can guess what I am now. I'm a zit. Get it?
All right, you bastard. Let's go right here.
That's such an evocative. Everyone who's seen that movie could picture that moment that Belushi just did. But yeah, you know, let's face it, food fights have been on film for a long time. It used to be the pie in the eye, and mm-hmm. it evolved into other things. And you know, obviously, Animal House, the hilarity of like gross cafeteria food being spread everywhere in this way. Yeah, very funny.
I have to wonder if this is the cultural origin of the Jell-O shot. Does it go back to John Belushi slurping his Jell-O in that way?
I don't know. Speedballs. I know it was a big part of his life, but I'm not sure he started those either. it is true. It is the first film that came to mind for me, although I think it's just because it has the word food in it. And so I didn't think of the food. I thought of the word first, food fight. But we got a lot of responses for that.
Yeah.
We also got many. This one is this next film also was about our most popular pick. Let's listen.
I'm Susan Smith from Durham, North Carolina, and my favorite food film is Babette's Feast, which in fact won an Academy Award for the best foreign film. It's a story of two elderly pious sisters who are carrying on a very tiny religious community that was set up by their father. And this community believes in shunning any sensuous pleasures, any ornamentation, anything flowery. And one winter night, at their door comes Babette with a letter of introduction from someone from their past saying that she's a refugee from, you know, political times in Paris, and this is during the 19th century. So she goes to the sisters, and she tells them that she'd like to prepare a French dinner for them in appreciation. People who were arguing with each other suddenly become nice to each other again, and the contrast between all of the people who are holding themselves back from saying or showing any pleasure, and the outsider who is just raving about each bite and each taste and can't, you know, just can't believe it, is very, very funny.
Many of the films in this list, I thought it was very interesting that they were foreign language films, and I can only think that it's that Americans have a very strange relationship to food. They are into denial. You know, they think somehow that enjoying every meal is a weakness somehow. And that European and Asian cultures perhaps do not see enjoying your food as the same moral failing that Americans do.
Yeah. Well, and Babette's Feast, I heard over and over and over. Are you talking about Babette's Feast? Are you talking about, yeah. So this is a big one, and it's the pleasure of watching the preparation. This is a preparation of the meal. It's like this 1-2 punch of all these people who have never eaten anything but the same gross gruel that you watch getting prepared by this amazing chef who decides to put herself in their universe, and then this one night of excess where she blows everything to give them this incredibly sensual experience when they've deprived themselves. I mean, that's the pleasure of that film.
But it's not just the eating, but the cooking that is the pleasure.
Yep,
and it's because it's a creativity, because it's a sharing, because it's an expression of love, even for people who perhaps don't want to accept the love.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe this gets back to your observation about so many foreign films on our list today. The idea that whatever our relationship is as Americans to food and eating together, the idea that sitting down, enjoying a meal, dawdling for 2 or 3 hours and spending all that time is exotic might appeal to directors as well. It's a way to sort of give you an exotic and an extremely common sensual. So it's something we've all done, but because we can blend cultures and talk about eating in new ways, I can also give you, I can take you around the world.
Well, right? One of the things that I thought of when we were talking about this was not a film, but there's a moment in Mad Men where they're promoting a fast food restaurant, and the characters go and sit in this very antiseptic fast food restaurant, and it's like, oh, we're like a family, and the camera pulls out, and it's like, this is what so many Americans' experience of a family meal is the antiseptic environment of a fast food restaurant.
Well, we talked to a lot of celebrity chefs, as we said, and we talked with listeners who called us and talked about their favorite food film. Let's hear from another North Carolina chef.
My name is Angela Salamanca, and I am from Central Mexican Restaurant in downtown Raleigh. My favorite food movie is Like Water for Chocolate. I love just how emotional and passionate it is, you know, and I feel like when you put your heart and soul in your food, people take that with them. There's two scenes that I love. One is the one where Tita and Nacho are mixing the batter for the wedding cake, and she starts crying because, you know, her mother made the love of her life marry her sister, and they made her cook the meal for the wedding celebration. So she's crying onto the batter.
Si Dios quiere. Sí. Suelta tus lágrimas, mi niña. Porque mañana no quiero que nadie te vea llorar.
And then as people start eating the cake, all their emotions of grief for their first love come to the surface and everybody gets sick. And I also love the other one where she received these flowers from her lover. So she makes a meal out of these flowers. And the emotion that is translated into the food is, you know, just like this crazy burning passion that they have for each other that's been unfulfilled. The book is incredible. It's just magical realism. It's such a powerful narrative, you know?
I remember so much when this novel came out, reading it in, I think, the late 80s, Laura Esquivel, Como Agua para Chocolate. And if I'm not mistaken, there was a recipe in each chapter. And I remember thinking, this is such an interesting, it was very woman-centric. And then when the film came out, I mean, it was one of, I think, the breakthrough Mexican films to really kind of open the door to more Mexican films getting distribution in the United States. And it is a really powerful combination, as Angela said, of this kind of love story, of sacrifice, and of what we put into cooking and into food that's not the literal ingredients, but that's so much more about emotion and feeling.
I mean, you say eating your feelings, and in most cases that means like a bag of Doritos. But this really...
When have you ever felt like a bag of Doritos? Go ahead.
But, you know, this is, you know, that the feelings that you have while cooking have a very tangible manifestation.
And what was so liberating about the idea of magical realism, both I think in literature and film, is that you could take that a metaphorical idea like that and make it literal.
And that's what magical realism, and I think we've talked about this before, but for people who love cooking, the idea of being in the kitchen, thinking about where this is going to go next as you're chopping the eggplant and cooking the tomatoes and knowing that it's going to be hours from now, but all of the people who you bought it from and who are going to sit at the table are in your mind. So it's a very tangible
experience. Well, that must happen for you all the time since you know your providers so intimately at the farmer's market.
I know every one of them and where it came from.
And it's like it's such an intimate thing that you're doing. I mean, you are feeding someone. What is more intimate than that? And so I think that's another important part of it.
Your favorite, Laura, Chocolat.
Yes, Chocolat. It's romantic with also that same, in a way, magical realism. Perhaps it's chocolate itself which seems to have the magical powers.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's listen.
Go ahead. It's your favorite.
What makes you so sure?
Go on, taste it.
That's fantastic.
Oh, thanks. I have a knack for guessing.
It's good. Not my favorite.
Sorry.
All right. Thanks very much.
Well, this has Johnny Depp in perhaps his last Dreamboat role. My daughter says after that, he didn't even really play a human being anymore. He kind of went off in different directions. But the thing that I like the most about it is that it's about listening to people and making connections, that you look deeply into someone's soul through your traditional healing powers, and you say, this is what is going to make you feel better.
You know, it's been a long time since I've seen it, but I also remember, wasn't it also about kind of breaking rules and getting people to let go of certain...
Right. Absolutely. It's about
rebellious.
Rebellious. It's to renounce your Puritanism, because it all takes place during Lent when everyone is forbidden to have these pleasures. And I can tell you this because it's on instant Netflix, so you can all watch it tonight if you want to. So someone is inspired to leave her abusive husband, and someone else to make a connection with her grandson. And the fact that the... Vienne, who is the heroine of the film, finds love in a way as almost an afterthought, because her love is about the sense of community and the connection, because this village is what the sustenance is.
On the state of things today, my guests are Laura Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art, Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State. We're talking about your favorite food movies on this edition of Movies on the Radio, and there's more to come. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking about your favorite food movies on this edition of Movies on the Radio. With me, as always, are Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State University, and Laura Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. And Marcia, we talked about Laura's favorite food movie before the break. What's yours?
Yeah, well, when I was looking through all the comments that people were sharing, I thought, well, there's no documentaries here. I need to do a documentary. And I thought, well, the best documentary that is about, quote unquote, food and eating is by a documentary named Les Blank, who passed away a couple of years ago. Fantastic California documentarian. And it's a film called Werner Herzog Eats His Shoe. And it requires just a little bit of context. It came out in 1980, or he made it in 1980. And Werner Herzog, the iconoclastic German director, talks in the documentary about this young lost soul, Errol Morris, who's trying to figure out what to do with
his
life.
That's your second pun, by the way.
Oh,
lost soul.
Man. Very quick, Frank.
Whew, got quicker than me. Or maybe not. But who has been talking and talking and talking about wanting to make a documentary. And Werner Herzog says, look, if you'll finally just make this bloody thing, I will eat my shoes. And so in good Herzogian fashion, he makes good on his deed. And Alice Waters, the very famous, wonderful California chef, helps him prepare the shoes. And that's what is depicted in this documentary.
Here we go.
When I started to think after a lot of work that I had done, I found out that for almost a year I had not cooked a meal. And... a grown-up man like me should not spend a week without having cooked a big meal.
What are you pouring in?
Some duck to soften it up. I think you should put some rosemary.
Yeah.
And then bread with the rosemary.
Okay, top of it.
It should be like a pig's foot that gets served. It's always a little, the leather should all soften up, and to serve it with something like the beans or a chili and lots of onions sprinkled on top and a little raw garlic and some spices like some oregano or some more of the
there's
rosemary.
There's a lot of garlic inside. I didn't mean to eat this shoe in public. I intended to eat it in the restaurant, but I was pushed a little bit into it, and it makes sense to some extent, because it should be an encouragement for all of you who want to make films and who are just scared to start and who haven't got the guts, so you can follow a good example. It's all right. Give me a little bite here. I think I won't eat the soles because it's so sticky now, it's rubber, and I won't eat that. When you eat the chicken, you leave the bones away. You have to swallow it.
I'm going to swallow a piece of beer. Not bad. It has a nice garlic flavor.
I mean, Herzog is the wonderful, brilliant madman of cinema, and I love that this is ultimately a documentary about commitment, and it's, as he puts it in that clip, about encouraging people to follow their dreams and not to wait for things to be handed to them, and about how garlic covers a lot of sins, too.
Well, this would make a great double feature with The Gold Rush with Charlie Chaplin, which he eats his shoe as well.
Well, and there's clips from The Gold Rush interspersed in Les Blank's documentary.
We suppose he had for dessert. Was it cobbler? Hey, that's some funny joke.
I suspect it was a lot of liquor.
You know, but also the ingenuity of it. I mean, I think it speaks to the ingenuity of a subtle message here, or maybe not so subtle, is, look, you can do this. You can take anything and make it a documentary if you know what you're doing and you have the passion for it. I can eat my shoe and turn that into a documentary, and it'll be a good one.
And he says he's eaten so much bad Kentucky Fried Chicken over the years, surely a pair of shoes will not kill him.
And there's also the fact that not everything that people eat in the movies tastes good. And of course, the thing that immediately comes to mind is Divine eating dog poo in Pink Flamingos. Mm-hmm. So that is certainly a memorable scene that nobody wishes to emulate.
Well, and of course, when you're actually making a movie and you're eating ice cream, you can't have ice cream on. It would be mashed potatoes or something else.
Which
so
is
it's,
why
it's
people,
all illusion.
People in the movies push their food around and don't actually eat it very often.
Well, throughout the show, we've been hearing from North Carolina chefs about their favorite movies. I think it's time to hear from another one.
I'm Chidi Kumar. I'm the owner and chef at Garland in downtown Raleigh. My favorite movie is Tempopo. It's basically a movie about a single mom, a newly single mom, who has a little noodle shop in a small, ostensibly small town in Japan somewhere. And she begins a quest with some two rogue cowboy-type figures to make the best bowl of ramen. So it's sort of a spin-off of a spaghetti western, haha noodles. It's very punny, and so they kind of break it down with, like, you know, the best noodle and, like, how much soda to use and how long it should sit, and then the broth and all of the things that people do, the secret ingredients. My favorite scene is there's a rogue gang of, like, street urchins, and they're all talking about the food that they've gotten out of the trash outside a French restaurant, and then they're going, you know, speaking very intellectually about all this. And so they ask her little son, like, what's your favorite dish, and what do you want us to make for you? And he said, omurice. And omurice is like a ketchup fried rice with an omelet, and sometimes the omelet is stuffed with the rice. But so he takes him by the hand, and they sneak in, they break into this building, and they happen to find a kitchen, and he makes, like, the most beautiful omelet you've ever seen. As the first time I think I saw somebody make an omelet in the true, like, French fashion, where he smacks the handle of the pan with his wrist and makes it a perfectly beautiful orb and presents it to the kid, and just when the security guard is coming in to bust them because he smells, like, you know, all this great food cooking, they sneak out at the other side. A real Marx Brothers moment in the movie.
Yeah, if you haven't seen this film, this is a great one. First off, it's totally anarchic and crazy. It's going to make you very, very hungry for ramen. So just be prepared and not that, you know, plastic wrap stuff that you buy at the supermarket. You want to make the real deal. But interspersed throughout this film are all these little food vignettes that are really absurdist and erotic. And I mean, it's a fantastic food worshiping film.
It was called, in the advertisements, an action movie about food. So they didn't want you to think that it was going to be boring, but that it really had a lot of drama and excitement.
Yeah, well, and it does. It has this kind of, the aspiration of nailing this perfect ramen recipe, and of these kind of two guys who come off the street to try to help this woman figure this out on this kind of food obsessive quest. It's, you know.
It does make me wonder if chefs can really even enjoy food movies if they're looking at the technical skills. It can really throw you off if it's not there. What if you hate the movie if they're, not using the knife the right way?
I'm sure there are many films that would be a subject for another show. What, this is your profession. What movie about your profession can't you stand because it's so awful?
Jot it down. There we go.
Coming soon.
That's a professions in which your profession is ruined in the making in the making of this film. A lot of foreign films, a lot of chefs who were looking at the art. Here's another film from another pick. This is the movie Chef, which, by the way, before we start this, This was a controversy. I mean, a lot of people loved this, and a lot of people hated this film. But let's listen to this clip.
My name is Dean Herring, and I'm from Raleigh, and my favorite food movie by far is Chef. It's a feel-good, buddy trip, father and son, husband and wife, find your passion, quirky movie with an awesome cast that happens to also have a happy ending. I double dog dare you to watch it and not desperately want a grilled cheese sandwich. There's no holiday from this
love. We will take a break, no.
I'm cuts off the press.
Yeah, well, I don't.
It's good.
Bay Rest, it's good.
It is a great movie because it was done pretty much outside the mainstream Hollywood big box system. And it succeeded. And then if you watch the end of the movie, the guy that helped him out is he's like an independent food truck owner. I think his name is Roy Choi or something like that. And he ended up being the co-producer. And then during the credits, they show you how Roy showed Jon Favreau how to make grilled cheese sandwiches.
The fun part is watching Roy get the stuff ready for this. So I try to watch him when he's preparing. I try to copy him. I can't do it, and I can get some of it.
You look at that, and you look at the scene where he makes one for his son, and it's just one of those things that says, man, I want a grilled cheese sandwich right now.
There you go. That's the movie Chef, one of our listener favorites today as we look at food films on Movies on the Radio.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, and, you know, Dean and a lot of other people will hate me for saying this, but this is a film that I just couldn't get behind. And part of it is this is one of those we talked about feel-good movies a few episodes ago, and it's so intentionally a feel-good movie that I just feel so manipulated by it, and I resist.
Well, a lot of people loved it. You know, the grilled cheese sandwich, we had Ruth Reichel was on the show a while back, and she talked about seeing a moose and being inspired to make the best grilled cheese sandwich of her life. And it was an incredible story.
A horned moose?
It was the four-legged animal. Okay. She was up in the North Woods somewhere, and it was all quiet. And then in the snow and the mists, out comes the moose. And she was then inspired, and I never really got to the bottom of this because we were running out of time, to make a grilled cheese sandwich. I'm not sure what the connection was, but she did it. And the description of the grilled cheese sandwich was driveway moments for everyone. They pulled over on 147, on 40. They stopped and listened to this description. We've never had so much mail about a sandwich
really?
In our lives as her description of the grilled cheese
sandwich.
Well,
and as Dean pointed out, I mean, that idea of a film that's focused on a particular kind of food that just makes you want it, you know, obviously that's another level at which this operates.
And it's the rare sort of deification of a simple American dish as well. And I mean the whole...
Which is unusual for this show. I mean, look at everything we're talking about
here. The whole idea of this film was sort of a getting back to basics and remake your life. I mean, it's enjoyable. It's predictable. There are many, many films that are predictable that you can still enjoy. Sorry, Marcia.
Chef, it's a lovely film. And let's hear from yet another celebrity chef on the State of Things.
My name is Phoebe Lawless, and I run Scratch Baking in downtown Durham. I gotta pick ratatouille. I love it when the rats take over the kitchen and prepare the meal for the food critic.
Colette,
don't say a word. If I think about it, I might change my mind. Just tell me what the rat wants to cook. Ratatouille? It's a peasant dish. Are you sure you want to serve this to Eagle?
Not only is it great at this point in my life because I can watch it with my kids, and I've watched it a lot with my kids the past couple years, but I love the seriousness or the smart approach that it takes with how cooks develop recipes. Food can be exciting and translate that to, you know, a broader audience that includes kids.
Here, chew it slowly. Mm. Only think about the taste. See?
Not really.
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness. You detect that?
Oh, I'm detecting nuttiness.
Close your eyes. Now taste this. Whole different thing, right? Sweet, crisp, slight tang on the finish.
Okay.
Now try them together.
Okay. I think I'm getting a little something there. It might be the nuttiness.
See?
It could be the tang.
That's it. Now, imagine every great taste in the world being combined into infinite combinations. Tastes that no one has tried yet. Discoveries to be made.
I think.
Uh-huh.
You lost me again.
Yeah.
And just to redeem myself, I do have a heart. I loved Ratatouille.
I'm
it's
sold.
A feel-good
I haven't
movie.
Seen it, but I'm sold. Just
yeah.
on that clip. I'm
mean, this
see
is
it.
Pixar animation, but I really appreciate the way Phoebe just talked about it as in terms of watching it with her kids and the idea of one of the things, obviously, you do when you watch films with your kids is you're exposing them to certain ideas and the idea of kind of a foodie culture and how do we cultivate taste and how do we make a recipe and also a rat wanting to be a chef, right? The enemy of all kitchens of the world, really. Right. The idea of being on the outside and wanting to figure out a way in.
But it's also about a child basically showing their elders that perhaps they have missed something. So it's a way of saying, you know, your parents might be right, but maybe they're not right all the time, and maybe you have something to teach them as well.
We have left out a whole subgenre here that one listener wrote in with an example, which would be Jaws. With humans as the main course, we left that out. But I will tell you, my favorite film in this genre would be Theater of Blood, Vincent Price, 1973. Did you ever say? It's great. He's a Shakespearean actor. He gets dissed by the critics. He feigns, well, he tries to commit suicide, isn't successful. They think he's dead. He comes back and comes up with poetic ways to do in all of his critics, a la Shakespeare. So he takes out one of their hearts, you know, Merchant of Venice, drives one to jealousy, kills his wife, Othello, right? It's great. But my favorite, the food part, so there's a gourmand critic who is also a dog fancier, has two poodles, or should I say head. It's great. It's this meal. It's in a cream sauce, and he's gobbling it up, and he says, oh, this is delicious. What is it? And then the chef comes out, and he lifts the lid, and there's two heads of poodles.
We did not go into the darker material until just now.
Dog lovers didn't like that.
But there are even movies where people have the misfortune of having a pet chicken, which is never, ever a good idea.
Back to Pink Flamingos, I guess.
Well, and yeah, I mean, the darker side of this, and one of the films that several people brought up with me was The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover, which is ultimately not only about food and overindulgence and excess, but about cannibalism. So there are
then,
darker sides.
And then you have to go
things.
To Monty Python's The Meaning of Life. One thin mint.
Wow, that was good.
So there's a whole other episode in this.
We're doing a whole other show.
Didn't even get to it. Laura Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Marsha Gordon, film professor at the North Carolina State University. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next month, we're going to have some fun talking about Oscar nominations, and we want to hear from you. A lot of controversy about the Oscars, but let's talk about what you think deserves an Academy Award. You can tell us your pick. You can use an existing category. You can make up your own, and you can criticize or love the Oscars in any way you want. We want to know your pick, your take on the Oscars. You can submit your suggestions at our website, stateofthings.org. It'll have some directions there on how to do it. State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton, and Andrew Tide. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.